We'll invite Lynn up to speak now. We'll then ask both of you to just give us a couple of minutes comment on the summary that I gave earlier, and then we'll open up to you for some questions. Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks very much. Good to be here. Can I just clarify, you want us to respond to the summary afterwards and do the set piece now? Excellent. Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much. This was the place of a health summit, I think probably about 2 years ago now, where people called for major change, major structural change in our health system, and not too much has happened in the meantime. By international standards, Australia has a reasonable health care system, but it's not necessarily the best, and it's certainly not without its problems. It's riddled with inefficiencies, duplication, cost shifting and buck passing between Commonwealth and states and territories. Incentives for private health insurance are clearly undermining universal access and pushing up the prices for everyone. There's too much emphasis on hospital care and too little on prevention and primary care. There's a chronic shortage of medical staff, which is aggravated by turf wars between professions and an outdated MBS system that is much too doctor orientated and rewards expensive diagnostic procedures over cheap preventive activities, or I should say cheaper, not cheap. And there are, of course, big differences in health spending from one geographic region to another, from one income group to another, and from one disease to another. Mental health is most notably underfunded, and teeth are regarded by the current government as being disengaged with the rest of the body, it seems, for the purposes of Medicare. And there are too many health inequalities, and they are growing, and nowhere is this more marked than between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. Having said all that, I doubt that we'll see major structural reform anytime soon. Tony Abbott backed down from his oft-stated threat to take over the hospitals, although it's probably about a year since we've heard one of those. And this month's meeting of the health ministers ended in a walkout because he wouldn't discuss the healthcare agreements until after the election. We strongly criticise him for that. Medibank is not set for major change now, now that the hoo-ha has died down about bulk billing, and psychologists and even midwives and would-be midwives have been brought under its umbrella. And I doubt we'll see any change either in the government's determination to prop up private health insurance through rebates despite its demonstrable policy failures. Social justice and addressing the widening health gap between the haves and the have-nots ought to be central to our health care system reform. And we need to be answering the questions, what must be done to make sure we have a sustainable, affordable health system, a system that will improve population health outcomes now and in the future and reduce those health inequalities. We know some of the answers. Local and international evidence points to steps that we could take to make sure that every dollar spent on health is wisely spent. So I'm going to go through, I think it's about seven of those points. Firstly, hold a national dialogue with the public on health care. We say there is an urgent need for national agreement on what are community expectations of the health system, expectations that are based on a common set of values, principles and priorities. So it could be citizens' juries or deliberative councils, roundtables or televoting. I understand was discussed a little earlier this morning, and they can all play a role in educating the public about the dilemmas and the limitations of a health system and help set priorities for health. Experience with these approaches has shown that the public, when given good information and asked to make resource-constrained choices, can do so and do so very responsibly. Secondly, establish a national preventative health task force and increase spending on prevention. I gather this has been a common theme today so far, and certainly not a new subject that people have been calling for. But the OECD estimated that 40 to 50% of premature deaths result from preventable behaviours. We spend a lot of money on sickness, most of it on hospitals and pharmaceuticals, and just 2% on prevention. Chronic conditions such as obesity and diabetes, heart disease, mental health problems are growing problems and we're not facing up to them. Rates of premature births are on the rise, bringing with them developmental delays and long-term health problems, and yet we're doing little to reduce rates or offset the long-term problems. And other countries do it better. The United States and Canada have preventive services task forces, but there is no agency driving this agenda in this country. Such a task force could provide cost-benefit advice on non-pharmacological prevention and treatment options, as the PBAC now does for pharmaceuticals. It could see that money was invested in non-pharmacological prevention and treatment research to balance the huge amounts that are spent on drug development in this country. We should also restructure the medical benefits schedule, which overvalues diagnostic and surgical procedures and encourages investment in such interventions to the detriment of lower cost primary prevention and self-care. We certainly need electronic medical records to be introduced. We talk a lot about this, but still don't have a minimal electronic patient record after nearly $1 billion of projects funded by state and federal governments. Electronic patient records that go with the individual would hugely cut the amounts of duplication and save time on collecting basic information, cutting down on the repeating of tests as people move from doctor to doctor and results are lost or not shared in a timely manner. Electronic medical records also have the potential to reduce medical errors by improving information sharing. Up to 30% of medical mishaps have been put down to lack of access to the necessary information. Four, we would support private health care but not private health insurance. Taking into account the 30% rebate, the 1% tax penalty and measures such as lifetime health cover support for the private health insurance industry is costing around $4 billion a year, and that's $3 billion in direct outlays and $1 billion in foregone revenue because of that 1% incentive. But this money is not adding any value. Private health insurance sucks up money in administration, drives overall health costs, and it doesn't deliver better care. If the government was to fund private sector providers directly, this would still provide support to the private sector, private health sector, and would save the administration cost. It would also give the government some control over those costs, something that the private health insurance sector has not been able to do. We would expand the roles of nurses and other healthcare providers. We need to be making much better use of our existing workforce, and this means reorganising the roles and responsibilities of our health professionals and in some cases creating new professions. It also means opening up MBS funding to other health professionals. The most obvious example of the need for reform in health is obstetrics and midwifery. In Australia, less than 10% of normal births are managed by midwives. In the Netherlands, that figure is over 70%, and UK and New Zealand, it's more than 50%. Australia lags behind the rest of the world because obstetricians are highly favoured through the medical benefits scheme and are very effective at protecting their patch. Many procedures carried out by doctors and specialists could be done by other health professionals. Nurse practitioners who prescribe medications, initiate tests and x-rays, refer to specialists and admit and discharge patients now number 65,000 in the US and are entrenched in its health system. In Australia, we have just 100. So we have to start making these decisions based on evidence and start tackling the barriers that are put up by some health professions. Six, we need to improve the quality and the safety through financial incentives in our system. We learned how dangerous healthcare can be 10 years ago when the first hospital safety report showed that each year 10% of Australian patients suffered an adverse event because of an error in their care and 18,000 people died as a result. Now that study hasn't been repeated, so we don't know what progress has been made. But anecdotal evidence is not altogether promising. The 2004 federal government report found 200,000 adverse events in the Australian hospitals in 2001-2. So We suggest there's a need for mandatory national open disclosure standards for when things go wrong, and we need financial incentives to safer care. Currently, we pay the same for good and poor quality care. We should link hospital accreditation, in our view, to demonstration of standards of safe care, and the Australian healthcare agreements should contain financial incentives to the states to improve the infrastructure for medical and surgical care. That doesn't mean hospital league tables, as suggested by Tony Abbott. We think it means more support for quality use of medicines and more rational use of pathology in all settings. And seven, we think there is a good case for state-based centres of excellence. The treatment that patients get for the same condition varies widely from doctor to doctor, hospital to hospital, and town to town. Patients requiring special care don't always receive it because the expertise is not available locally. We need to reduce the wild fluctuations in quality of health by letting go of our obsession with providing all health care close to home. Cost-effective, quality, specialised care needs patients to be mobile, and we need to develop the systems to support them and their families. And just to finish on a word with a word about Indigenous health. I was appalled at the jackboots approach, to Indigenous, the abuse of Indigenous children. There certainly was an urgent need to act, but we were highly critical of the way the government did that, and deeply worried that because Indigenous people were not involved, as I think Tom Kalmer said earlier, that this would end up doing more harm than good. We've known for some time that the most urgent reform needed is in Indigenous health and wellbeing. I think most people are in agreement. There's no easy answer or magic solution to this problem. The issues are quite profound and they are difficult. There is, however, a wealth of evidence that shows that Indigenous Australians are not getting their fair share of the health dollar, and when level of need is taken into account, spending is way below that which is needed to solve the Indigenous health crisis. We need to spend more on high-quality health services for Indigenous Australian services that recognise social, cultural and spiritual aspects of health, and that are planned and run and delivered locally by Indigenous people. But there will never be equality in health for Indigenous Australians without equality in circumstances. A major part of the answer to addressing health inequality must lie in increasing opportunities for meaningful experiences in education and employment, ensuring access to adequate food and housing, and creating safe environments. And these, of course, have to be very long-term commitments.
Thank you very much for that, Lynn.